is another sub-series, our monthly sub-series, short takes about sustainability in Japan. I'm JJ Walsh in Hiroshima, Japan, joined by...
Hi, I'm Tova Kinooka in Yokohama.
And every month we get together, we talk about some issues and projects we've been working on, but also things that have kind of been on our radar. We are both focused on sustainability-focused business and organizations and travel. Tova, would you like to start about food loss?
Right. So I'm also part of the BCCJ, the British Chamber of Commerce. And last week, finally, we were able to do an event that's been sort of on our plans for a couple of years now on food loss and food waste in Japan. And it's interesting because I think, you know, maybe on the surface, people don't realize that the scale of this issue, it's really huge, right? And so we had three speakers that we invited. So the first one, Obata-san, was from the Norinchukin Research Institute. So you can see him on the right there behind the podium. And he kind of gave us an overview of what the situation in Japan is. And he gave a lot of really sort of interesting stats, and the report, the event report will come out hopefully in next week, and that'll have sort of all the sort of the points he covered. But one point that really stuck with me is that in Japan, the total amount of food loss each year, and this is edible food that's disposed of, you know, it could be eaten, but it's not, it's wasted for whatever reason, is 5.23 million tons per year. Or metric tons, sorry, per year. And the food aid provided by the World Food Programme per year is 4.8. So this is, we're wasting more than the World Food Programme is providing in aid.
Is that just in Japan?
That's just in Japan. And if you magnify that globally, it's terrifying. It really is. You know, insane how much we're wasting. And it can be for all sorts of reasons. So he looked at kind of where in the value chain, if you like, are things being wasted. And obviously sort of at the production end, there's waste happening sort of in the fields. Often places won't, sort of supermarkets, buyers, et cetera, won't take ugly fruit, veg, or anything that has slight blemish on the skin, particularly here where perfection is really prized for fruit and veg. So often it'll just get left there. During the transportation process and packaging and things like that, there's more sort of damage and loss that happens there. But actually, in sort of, if you're looking at it by category, the largest category is around sort of the household waste. So buying more than we need, things then go out of date, people throwing away out of date food that would still be perfectly edible, but just because it has a date on it, or it, you know, has a slight bruise or a blemish. And, you know, we've, I suppose, grown up in such a time of abundance that we don't feel the need to hold on to any sort of little imperfect thing. Whereas perhaps, you know, previous generations where the resources were scarce, they might have taken sort of more care of, okay, well, what can we do with this, even if it is damaged or not perfect? So lots of things happening there. People sort of not understanding how to correctly kind of reheat and reuse leftovers and things like this. So they sort of chuck it out thinking it's not safe or it can't be useful.
Can I just add one strategy? So I'm going to talk about going to the Ogasawara Island, which was really cool. And one of the strategies, because food insecurity is a big issue there, but they do have locally grown tomatoes. Mm. And one of the guides, she's also a warden for the forest, and she's always looking for strategies. And she said, because they grow tomatoes here, but they don't sell the ugly ones, or there's just something not quite right about it, what we've started to do is communicate to the farmers and get them and freeze them. And she's like, it makes the most beautiful sauce.
Of course.
Everybody's really happy to have them. So it's just having those strategies in place. And then the farmer's happy, they're happy, less food loss, right? So there are possibilities. We just have to start thinking about how to do that, right?
That's the key. I mean, you use the word thinking there, and that was something that came up a lot. So we did these sort of, had presentations from three different people looking from different perspectives. So Marcus Koch there is from, he's the GM of the Hilton Tokyo Bay, and has had huge success using technology, but also really working on the mindset and the culture among the kitchen and restaurant staff of how they plan menus and the food flow through restaurants, particularly with, you know, large scale buffets and things like that. And then Darren Prest, who's his own company does the catering for Yokohama International School. And again, sort of looking at portion sizes and where they're sourcing ingredients and how they're planning out the week's menu so that they can plan to use leftovers in dishes on the final day of the week and stuff like this. There are a lot of things that are around mindset and behavior change. The processes are not difficult to do very often. It's about changing habits and behaviors and the way we look at food. So
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And when you go to the supermarket after a certain time in the day, everything is discounted. And you do see people going who know about that and buying the cheaper bentos before they're taken off.
Exactly.
You know? So it's still definitely safe to eat it, but you can get a discount and you can help out with the food loss or the food waste, right?
Yeah, very much, very much. And it was fun because in the second half of the events, we heard from these three sort of presenters, but then the second half we did sort of table discussions on, you know, okay, what can we do to reduce food loss in our homes, our communities, and our workplaces? Three sort of themes. And the groups were so mixed. We had the sort of heads of big global finance organizations. We had a high school student who's doing a project on this in her school and was really interested. You can see her in the picture in the middle there, Moira. And then we had sort of people who run their own businesses. We had consultants. We had a real sort of, we had an executive chef from the Park Hyatt and stuff come along. This wonderful French guy. And it was just so interesting to get all these different perspectives and just little things that we could share with each other and go, yeah, we can do that. That's easy. We could do that in our company, in our, you know, when we have an event or at home. So yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing the write-up of all those ideas and sharing that.
Oh, that's great. And you mentioned, I think you've mentioned before about that Hilton has a strategy called Winnow, an electronic system to help them monitor how much food waste is going in the bin and identifying it using, I guess, AI technology, maybe.
Yeah. So that's really cool. So Winnow is, it's not part of Hilton, but they partner with Hilton and IKEA and other big organizations globally, anywhere that's sort of using and producing food, I guess. And the AI system recognizes, so you teach it sort of what are the items you have in your kitchen, your restaurant, whatever. And then it can recognize, oh, this is when it's been thrown into the bin, and it can tell you how much of what item was thrown away on this particular day. And then just visualizing, having that visibility on what's going in and how much that's costing. That's a really, really key one as well. You're like, we threw away this much of, you know, this item, and that's how much that's worth. And it's like, oh, wow. And actually in his presentation, Marcus gave us the numbers for that, and it was staggering, actually. And he said, okay, so when we were able then to see that and recognize it and change behaviors to say, okay, well, all food waste goes in this one bin where we're measuring everything. It used to be in sort of different ones, but it all goes in that one. Then we can, you know, track everything. And then they'd look at it at the end of each day with the restaurant staff. And they're like, oh, okay. So how do we reduce that? And here's how much that cost us. And here's how many people that could have served and this kind of stuff. And when you can see it that way, then I think it gets people to see the impact of what, you know, they're doing and change behavior. So it's really, really cool.
Absolutely. And another great strategy I saw in Ogasawara, which you've also seen in Kamikatsu, and we don't see much in Japan, is how to reduce your waste by 30% quickly.
Yeah.
How do you reuse any organic waste? Compost. Yeah. Right? So it was really nice to see composting systems in place. Collecting all the namagomi compost and then digging it back into the earth. Now, this is nature reserves, so they are very careful about keeping out predators or things that are going to damage local flora, fauna, and wildlife. Mm. And they can do it. So we can definitely do it everywhere around Japan and around the world. And
Absolutely.
it's a way to reuse some of that food
Yeah.
loss, right? And
Yeah.
back into nature.
That's interesting, actually, because I mean, you mentioned that sort of doing it in nature reserves there. And I think people have this assumption that in order to be able to compost, you must have a garden or all this space. But there are systems where you don't need that. We use a bokashi box system that does not smell. You can get sort of very self-contained sort of wormery ones that, again, the actual space you need for those is really limited. You could have it on a balcony and then you can use it in your pot plants and things like this. You don't need a huge space to do that.
And then there's even electric ones that dry it
Yeah,
out, right?
that's
And then
right.
that's easier to take away the smell. And then you
Yeah.
use it even in potted plants. I know that's quite popular as well.
Exactly. Yeah, and great for urban areas, right?
Yeah. Since I started talking about Ogasawara, I
On
guess
you go.
we'll talk
Yeah,
about
looking
it.
forward to hearing about
So
this.
I've got more and more coming out because the articles that I was sent there to write about will start coming out. So more details. But basically, Ogasawara Islands is controlled by Tokyo. You can only get there by 24-hour ferry from Tokyo. And it is a beautiful chain of 30 islands, including one that most people recognize, Iwo Jima, which movies has been made about and everything, very historically relevant about wartime. But only two of the islands are lived on. And so we first went to Chichijima, and it was great to see all of the tropical fruits that you can get and quite a lot of the local produce like bananas and papayas here and tomatoes, coffee, star fruits. Have you ever seen that? The
I was
bottom
going to
right,
say,
star
is that
fruit?
the bottom right corner there, the
Yeah. And
green
then
thing?
passion fruits in the middle, hibiscus. So for me, growing up in Hawaii and then going to the Ogasawara Islands, it was so nice. It really felt like old Hawaii. And then I knew it might be a challenge to be vegan while I was there, but I was really pleased and surprised that when I took, this was my first time doing this, I took a packet of dried vegan osawa dashi. So the vegan stock for soup. And I asked at the restaurants, do you think I could use this? Or you just give me the noodles with hot water and I can do it. And he's like, oh no, I'll take it. And then they were so flexible and so easy to help. So I had these beautiful like tempura noodle dishes as well. So that was really nice. So that was a surprise. I had brought all my own food, didn't need it, which was nice to see. One of the main things I also noticed a lot of houses reusing everything that washed up, and all the beaches were very clean. So there's a real local habit and drive to clean all the beaches. Of course, like everywhere around the world, they do have a lot of plastic washing up. Even Galapagos has this challenge, right? But you really notice people working hard to get it out of the beaches and make sure it doesn't become part of the ocean problem. And when you are on the coast, we saw humpback whales coming all the time, even from the coast. And they're famous for humpback whales and sperm whales come through different times, lots of dolphins. The Hahajima Island was the first in Japan to change from whaling to whale watching in the 80s. So it
Wonderful.
was really the first place they started ecotourism. And then they have really special snails endemic to that area. You can only see certain kinds of snails. And we did a nature hike and learned about how the trees got there. Floating on the water, those seeds that I was holding in the right, you know. So there's so many interesting things, but also you've got these historical sightseeing areas. Like this is a sunken battleship that was in one of the swimming bays, and they kept it there, and you can snorkel out and see it on the left. This was one of the coffee farms that we visited. Her family had been living there doing coffee, and then everybody was moved off during the occupation after the war and then moved back. So there's a lot of interesting historical stories there as well. One of the key things I was sent there to talk about is bio toilets. There's not a lot of bio toilets around Japan, but it is a very sustainable strategy, especially somewhere where you're trying to protect the nature preserve. Yeah. So the fact that it doesn't need power, it doesn't need water, it doesn't need a sewage tank is a big deal. And so they're kind of, Tokyo government is kind of using the Ogasawaras as a place to try bio toilets because it's needed for locals and visitors, but also as a great strategy to put all around Japan because you can use it even in times of disaster, even when the water and power shuts off, you can still use these. So it is, it's a great new technology.
Kind of. That's fantastic. Yeah, like you say, the emergency sort of aspect of it is really good. But also there are so many places in Japan that are very remote. So I'm just thinking of when we went to Kamikatsu and stuff. And there are so many places that are really physically very far away from any kind of infrastructure. And so options like that would actually be really helpful and, you know, a great sort of viable option there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So it's UNESCO nature certified, like it's one of the top most natural, beautiful areas in the world. And also a natural preserve by Japanese national parks. So it's preserved two sides, but still, you know, you go there and you're like, I know it's a nature reserve. I'm expecting too much. And then you see plastic bottles, you know, even plastic straws, and you're like, but this is
the norm. Need the mindset shift around that.
Yeah, but local people, you know, they are more aware and they're definitely living closer to nature. So yeah, a lot of great insights there. Now, you also had a very people-focused sustainability seminar. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this was with Steelcase, which is a kind of an office design and sort of furniture company based in the US, but they're global, they're everywhere, and they have an office here in Japan. And they've been running these series of, this was the second one, sort of sustainability roundtables, just very casual, bringing together a diverse group of people from different industries and backgrounds to look at a particular aspect of sustainability. So this time we were looking at the people side of sustainability, things like well-being, mental health, physical health, and how that work sort of relates to workplace design and organizational sort of policies around work and things. So it was really interesting looking at the sort of they do a lot of research as well. So they've got a magazine that comes out sort of quarterly that I've been digging into here, and there's a digital version available as well if you go to their website. But they looked at, okay, so for an example here, sort of there's been this trend to make offices really open, right? It's getting away from cubicles or whatever and really having these big open spaces, all very beautifully designed. So they look fantastic and very inclusive when you first go into them. However, what we found through hearing different perspectives in the discussion was that for some people or for certain types of work as well, that's really not the best approach. So we were talking about, you know, that sometimes you just really need a quiet space to focus, maybe to do an online call or something, or just time where you won't be disturbed, where you can really just concentrate. And then other times you do need a more open space for brainstorming or for coming up with ideas here. So there, it's sort of gone from one extreme to the other. So if you look back sort of in the past, and they were looking at the sort of 40s and 50s and stuff around that, it was all cubicle, 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 and everyone had their little space. And that structure, it maybe, you know, has had its time. And then it went to this huge kind of, like people imagine, I think you've seen pictures of the Google headquarters and, you know, Facebook's offices and stuff. And it's all beanbags and bright colors and plants and all wonderful. But for a lot of people, that's actually a very uncomfortable and stressful environment, for quieter people, for neurodiversity, or for just when you need to just sit down and focus and get stuff done, and you really can't be having all that noise going on around you. So it was really interesting to look at that and go, well, okay, so what are the solutions? What works? And how does that also factor in sort of the combination of sort of remote work and in-person work as well, because that seems to be a trend that's going to continue. Hybrid work is kind of evolving, right? And so that we need to also factor in how the design of the space needs to adapt to that reality, and have kind of areas where there can be screens of people who are remote can really feel like they're still part of that meeting and be included. Or if people have mobility issues and can't come in, they can still be included in those conversations. So it was, yeah, very interesting discussion.
That is really interesting. And the whole idea, like on the website, which I added the link below, talking about design tensions.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So you can't, there's not one size fits all, right? So people want creative spaces and other people want really quiet focus spaces. So how do you manage that tension when you're designing a new office or reconfiguring the office or whatever? How do you balance the needs of the few with the needs of the many, and all these different sort of areas of tension they talked about. So really, really interesting. Because there was one guy there from a big German company who was talking about that they're building a massive new office near Kawasaki. And he's like, well, we've got thousands of people coming together from different sites who are all going to be working in this office. And so they'd been trying to kind of do needs surveys of employees, like, what do you want of this office, da, da, da. But the needs were just so varied. He's like, well, how do you, at the end of the day, we've also got to fit everything in, and it's got to be within the budget and the space and this, that, and the other. So you've got all these sort of tensions that you were saying there. There's a lot to consider that maybe we just going into the office or a workspace each day, you don't even think about that. But
yeah, there's a lot of dynamics you don't think about, right? Like what is the greatest, the most productive, but also the most supportive for the emotional and physical needs of your workers, right?
Yeah.
And then now coming back from COVID, maybe some people want to work at home some days of the week, only come into the office a few days a week is the new trend, right?
Exactly. And if they're coming in, it's likely they're coming in probably for face-to-face meetings or more kind of creative types of work rather than the quiet focused stuff that they can do at home by themselves. So then, you know, maybe the ratio of the space you have in the office needs to change as well. Or spaces, one thing that was discussed was flexible spaces with having things that are not fixed. So walls, dividing walls that can move, furniture that can be fairly easily moved around without having to, you know, get people in to do it. You know, people can move themselves and reconfigure stuff. So all of these kind of things as well was an interesting sort of takeaway for me, I think.
Yeah, interesting. And this is something that we need to think about moving forward.
Very much.
And then how do we integrate with AI technology and computers and robots? This is all forthcoming, right?
Yeah, very much. I know. Yeah. And even the intergenerational differences were interesting. So my daughter, who's very interested in design and also behavioral stuff, came and joined the conversation. So she's 17. And then we had, you know, a full range of sort of younger employees through to sort of those of us who are a bit older. And I wasn't quite the oldest in the room, but not far off. But it was just really good to get all these different sort of generational expectations and needs and differences as well. We don't all work the same way. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Speaking of design, I talked to a woman and her husband living in Fukuoka about Japanese houses and earthquakes. So they had lived in Germany. They had lived in the UK. When they came to Japan, they were looking for an old house. But when they found a place they loved, they wanted to make sure it was safe for earthquakes. And so they had three different assessors come in. The first two assessment teams were quite young architects and builders. And they said, you can't make it earthquake safe. You have to rebuild. But the third older run remodel company guy who had experience with old houses said, you can definitely rebuild and make it safe for earthquakes. And so they had lots of great insights, including this within the walls, adding, they called a damper, which can apply flexibility, but stability as well to the wall structure. So it was a really fascinating talk if you're interested in this, yeah. I'll put the link below. But she also had earthquake safety and preparation ideas. Mm. She's written a few great Medium articles about this, like what to keep in your bedroom in case yeah. you can't get somewhere else. Mm. And then securing your tall bookcases and things that might fall over. Really practical advice there as well. Yeah. But you know, this is such a big issue this year with having the huge earthquake in Noto. We just had a little earthquake in Hiroshima, and I noticed when I checked online, Noto is still having aftershocks. That must be really scary. I'm sending out lots of warm thoughts and hope and support yes. to them. But the idea that it's not the problem with old houses, as long as your old house is in good condition, make sure you get someone to assess, add support if you need it. But there is strategies that you can have to keep these old houses. It's not impossible
no.
to have an earthquake safe traditional house, which is great.
Yeah, well, that's good to know and good to see sort of examples of that that other people can learn from.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Now, you also watched something about networking, but a more natural kind. You tell us about this fantastic fungi documentary.
Well, this anyone who knows me will probably be laughing because they know that I hate eating fungi. Okay, despite the fact I'm a biologist and find them fascinating from a scientific perspective, I absolutely detest eating them. However, this documentary, I mean, if you get a chance, watch it. I've been waiting for ages and was really excited to watch it finally with the whole family. It looks at all the stuff that we really don't know about fungi, right? And about the, we just see these bits, the all the different sort of interesting and wonderful designs that we might see sort of on a hike or a walk in the park or something like that. But underground, there's this incredible network, the mycelium network, that is enormous. We can't even comprehend how enormous this is. But they were talking in the documentary about the function of this and how important this is for supporting our whole ecosystem of life on Earth. So the fact that it sequesters carbon, you know, it pulls it down, the trees, the plants above pull it in, that goes down into the mycelial network. And then it's, you know, it's contained there in a completely natural way. So these, particularly the old growth forests with very sort of deep and wide sort of mycelial networks, are taking, drawing down and storing a huge amount of carbon. And there's a whole sort of exchange going on between the trees, between the various plants underneath. Of course, they're breaking down dead plant matter, dead sort of animal matter as well, and recycling the nutrients into the system. So they are absolutely essential for our lifestyle. And yet very often they're seen as either a bit sort of scary or dangerous or, you know, don't touch this or we don't want it, get rid of the things. And of course, there are some that are harmful that we need to, you know, sort of be conscious of, but a huge number of them, and there are tens of thousands, if not more, of species, are actually a really, really important part of our ecosystem. So it was fascinating, absolutely fascinating.
That's awesome. And I just noticed at the farmer's market I walked through yesterday, they've got loads of huge shiitake mushrooms for sale. I love to grill those up and have them as like a mushroom burger, like really natural version. And I'm so excited to see so many vegan burgers, which are mushroom based. And they taste, you don't like eating them, but I love eating them. They taste amazing, but they're just so, like you said, they're regenerative. They're yeah. so good for the planet. Brilliant. So more mushrooms, the better in many things. Even insulation. I've been yes. reading about house yep. insulation using mushrooms.
Yeah,
they're incredible in various ways that we need in yeah. our house and life and everything.
Yeah, they gave some great examples in the documentary of, yeah, sort of packaging, for example, instead of polystyrene packaging in boxes and things, stuff made with mushrooms, a type of concrete kind of replacement. Just, that, you know, that there are so many options. They're really very amazing organisms. So, yeah, as long as I don't have to eat them.
How about in a burger? Could you eat them if they're like, no, really? If even if it doesn't taste smell. Like mushroom? No, nothing?
I can just about tolerate them if I can't taste them or smell them and they're mushed down into something else, I can tolerate them to be polite if I have to.
But mushrooms are a huge deal in Japanese food culture as well, right?
I know. So very often when I go to somewhere and I say,
expensive dishes are made with expensive mushrooms.
Yeah, you can imagine how well that goes down when I go to restaurants. Yeah, vegetarian, but also no mushrooms. What do we feed you?
Well, maybe you can tolerate them in your house and other functions, just not eating them.
Exactly. Yeah. As long as I'm not eating them, I'm good.
All right. Well, that's our 30 minutes. Thank you so much, Tova. Thanks, everyone, for joining. And we'll see you next month with more sustainable short takes. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye. Have a great day. Way out, he'll shout goodbye.